those men who chased us this morning. I couldn't help myself. I was so frightened. I wet my pants. Grandma made her way through the broken glass to peek out the window, then looked back and signaled us to lie flat. Without making a sound, she took the rifle, opened the window, and rested the gun barrel on the sill. Slowly, she squeezed off a shot. The noise it made was like a big explosion. Bingo! I hit it!
Hit what?
I whispered. The old metal oil can. You know, the trash burner, Grandma said happily. That might give them something to think about. As she fired again, we heard people whispering and running along the side of our house, and finally the slamming of car doors. A few minutes later, Mrs. Conyers, our next-door neighbor, called.
You all got a problem in your backyard, she told us. After all that noise you all made over there, three white men scooted out of your yard as fast as flying bullets. Mr. Conyers says they were all he could see, but just the same, he's got his double-barreled business partner loaded, and he's a-fixin' to give you all some backup. A couple of the other neighbors are gonna prowl around to see what they can find.
But, she added, her husband advised us not to call the police. White cops ain't no help in these kind of situations. Besides, then they'll know exactly where you live and hang your butts for sure. As I lay in bed that night, I felt so frightened I couldn't cry. Instead, I lay silent for hours, listening to noises outside, wondering if the men had really gone away and when they would come back. 7.
You're one of those people integrating Central High, the man with the scruffy beard said. Bang! Bang! Bang!
His gun went off. I clutched my chest. I'm dead. I sat straight up in bed, soaked with perspiration. There it was. The bang! Bang! Again! Was someone shooting through our window? I jumped out of bed and ran down the hall. Great! I'm running. Maybe I'm not dead. I wanted someone to tell me I wasn't dead. Grandma! Grandma India! I called to her as I darted in and out of every room in the house.
I'm here, in the living room, she answered. What's the matter?
I came to a screeching halt and tried to catch my breath. There she was, perched on top of a chair, stretching her arms high above the television set, nailing a picture to the wall.
Won't do to have bullet holes in the wall, she said. Somebody will stop by and want us to explain it. We can't make a big deal of what happened last night, you know.
I gripped the back of the chair she stood on to steady it.
There.
You see? I always liked the sheep in that picture. Their faces are smiling out at us from a heavenly pasture. I held her hand as she climbed down from the chair.
Kinda hard on a girl getting shot at that way, huh?
She said, as she touched my cheek with her forefinger and winked at me.
But you don't seem none the worse for it. You look like you're full of zest and vinegar this morning.
I'm frightened, I whispered. I reached out to hug her, seeking the safety of her arms. She was wearing a freshly starched dress and apron, and smelled of vanilla extract.
A little vanilla behind the ear always helps a woman's femininity,
she often said. I loved her so much, just for an instant. I thought how awful it would have been if the gunman had hit her.
So, Missy, you slept right through your mama and brother leaving for school.
She carried the chair back to the dining room, placing it just so. Then she paused and turned to look back at me.
Well, get dressed. I'll make you some hot oatmeal with raisins. After I go to the store for putty, we'll sit and talk a spell until Mr. Claxon gets here to fix the window.
May I go with you to the store?
Absolutely, positively not.
she said.
You're not going out of this house today for any reason.
As I dressed, I fretted that if Grandma wouldn't allow me to go anywhere today, she might not let me go with her to the wrestling matches. Surely, nothing that awful could ever happen to me. I put it right out of my mind. So there we were, Grandma and me, giggling and talking together over the breakfast table, just like always. It felt like a very normal morning. For a short while, I forgot the shots and integration. But as we started cleaning up the breakfast dishes, I saw her favorite green vase, now shattered in 1,000 pieces in the trash can. It reminded me of the bullets and what might happen come nightfall. Then the wretched phone call started. Shaking hands and a pounding pulse were my responses to the ring of the phone, no matter how hard I tried to ignore it. The shrill sound went on forever. Grandma had decided she wasn't going to play phone tag with hecklers. When the doorbell rang, I jumped. But it was only Mr. Claxton, Grandma's friend. When I teased her about his being her boyfriend, she said I shouldn't be getting into grown-ups' private business. But I noticed she had put on just a touch of lipstick and a black bow in the back of her hair before he arrived. All of a sudden, I heard loud talking in the front hall. Grandma and Mr. Claxton were exchanging harsh words. I wanted to see what was going on up close, so I tiptoed past, announcing I was going out to get the newspaper. I heard him say the gunshots through our window were a clear sign that I should withdraw from Central, because I would bring the white people's wrath down on our community. In a very loud, strong voice, Grandma said he should mind his own business. That morning's newspaper showed a picture of Minnie Jean and Jeff at the federal building as they filed reports about our being turned away from Central. Most of the headlines in the Gazette were about us and integration. On the front page, a headline stating, "Decisions of North Dakota Judge Reverberate Through All of Dixie," crowned a picture of Judge Ronald Davies. There he was. The man who had ordered the governor to move ahead with integration was pictured right there on the front page. He had the same huge, kind, all-knowing eyes as Grandma. Davies, from Fargo, North Dakota, who described his career as humdrum, had landed in the middle of a racial battle that may have repercussions for the entire South, the article said. This man, who stands 5'1" and ran 100 yards in 10 seconds at the University of North Dakota, had come to Little Rock 2 weeks earlier to clean up a backlog of cases in the Eastern District of Arkansas. Twice, he had interrupted his regular duties to rule on crucial matters pertaining to integration. Two nights before, it had been Davies who heard pleas from the Little Rock School Board's attorney asking what to do, considering that Farbus was ringing Central High with troops. "Move ahead with integration," Davies had said. Although mild-mannered, the paper said the 52-year-old judge could sometimes be testy and speak brusquely. As I read more about Judge Davies, I didn't think he was humdrum at all. The next article actually made me laugh aloud, under a headline that read, "Situation at School is Getting Smelly." It said the National Guard blockade at Central was creating a smelly situation at homes in the vicinity because the guards weren't allowing non-white garbage collectors to get through their barricades.
"You can't live your whole life in that newspaper, girl. Get busy with your day."
With my arms in soap suds up to my elbows, I could feel pretty ordinary and forget about newspapers and headlines and integration. Washing clothes with Grandma and hanging them on the line was a meditation, she always said. A little later, unable to take the ringing telephone any longer, I picked up the receiver. It was the NAACP asking me to go to Mrs. Daisy Bates' house that afternoon for a news conference. I wondered how Grandma would feel about my going. More than once, I had heard her say that giving interviews was just asking for trouble.
You don't want to be singled out.
Still, I was anxious to go because it meant I would get to see the others. I was going stir crazy. I decided to wait to get permission until Grandma was in her very best mood. By the time Mr. Claxton had finished repairing the window, I noticed that Grandma's anger toward him had cooled considerably. He cooed at her as he headed for the front door, and she smiled, like a flustered schoolgirl with a crush. After she closed the door behind him, she turned to discover that I was watching and resumed her strictly business manner.
Did I tell you someone called from your church office? The Negro Interfaith Ministers Organization is speaking out on your behalf, saying Farbus is not living up to his responsibility to all the people he represents.
Maybe he'll listen, I said.
They say a dozen or so white ministers in Little Rock are going to do the same.
Great, I thought to myself. Maybe now Governor Farbus will see that he has been unfair and change his ways. Shortly after Mr. Claxton left, the church ladies arrived with baskets of food.
So the white people won't catch you all shopping and chop your heads off,
Mrs. Floyd said with an acidic smile as she brushed past me. She was Grandma's very good friend, but she wasn't at all in favor of the integration.
We have our place, and we do the best when we stay in it, she said.
Her words made me tense up, but I knew she meant well. She had no way of knowing about last night's shooting and how much the things she said hurt my feelings. The ladies included bags of store-bought things as well as homemade treats. They uncovered their bowls and heavy metal pots, releasing inviting aromas that made my mouth water. Right away, I could tell Grandma was getting real impatient with all their talk of whether or not we ought to be stirring up the integration pot.
We're just getting settled on the front of the bus,
one of them said.
Why not wait a while till the white folks get used to having us around? In 5 years or so,
another added.
Nonsense.
I knew I could count on Grandma's feisty friend, Mrs. Gray, who shook her finger in their faces.
Why, folks ain't never giving us nothing. Getting from them's been like pulling dinosaur teeth. We gotta grab everything we can and most times pay for it with our blood. You just move right along, girl, you hear me? You integrate now.
And so it went as they scurried about. Grandma was mostly silent, with the kind of expression that let me know she was about to burst from holding in what she really thought. She was polite, but firm in explaining we had lots of chores to do and couldn't tarry. They headed for the front door.
Well, said Mrs. Floyd indignantly, none of this would be necessary if you'd stayed out of that white school where you're not wanted.
I wanted to say something and then remembered what an awful sin Grandma said it was to show disrespect to an adult. I knew for certain I shouldn't be talking back to one of the ladies in our church, whom I would have to see every Sunday for the rest of my life. I walked back into the house without saying a word, feeling as if I had been surrounded by enemies, even in my own neighborhood.
It's like opening day at the rodeo here,
Grandma said an hour later, breathlessly racing through the living room to answer the front door once more. I was under strict orders never to answer the door by myself. When the bell rang, I was to move to the center of the house. If the visitor was friendly, I could relax. If it were someone up to no good, I had to hide in the closet, or better still, run for the back door and escape.
It's your father. Brace yourself. He's not in a great mood,
Grandma whispered, hurrying back to the kitchen. Daddy came storming in, huffing and puffing his anger.
I'm not the kind of man that takes on over his I told you so's, but the fact is I told you it would be this way.
He shouted loud enough to be heard as far away as Texas. Grandma came rushing back from the kitchen to stand in the doorway. He looked at her with angry eyes, pointing his finger at me and shouting in harsh tones that made my knees shake.
Sacrificing this child's life and endangering the lives and jobs of kinfolks ain't got nothing to do with freedom. We ain't free if we're hungry, or worse yet, hanging from a tree. Shut your mouth, Will Patillo. Don't make this child doubt her good deed.
Grandma shouted back. That was just the beginning of an awful string of mean words Papa and Grandma exchanged about me and the integration. The only good thing about his visit was that he hugged me goodbye.
You know, don't you, that I'm only thinking of what's best for you. You're too young to be in this kind of mess.
He squeezed me hard, pressing my head against his chest with his huge, warm hand. He hadn't hugged me for more years than I could remember. I stayed in his arms for what seemed like a long time, savoring his strength. I wanted him to come back home, to stay with us the way he did before the divorce. I needed him to help make the shooters go away.
I love you, baby, he said
as he walked out the front door. And when I asked if he'd come back later that evening to help us, he answered,
maybe if you all get scared enough, you'll quit this nonsense.
He turned and walked away. I slammed the front door hard, but I stared after him through the window for a long, long time. The home of the NAACP president, Mrs. Bates, stood amid a pristine row of elegant residences in one of our community's nicer neighborhoods. This meeting marked the first time all nine of us had come together since soldiers and the mob turned us away from Central High. As we drove up to the house, I told Mother I was curious about whether the others had been shot at, but she said,
don't you dare mention one word about the men chasing. All the shooting in our window. Do you hear me, girl?
Yes, ma'am, I said, locking the car door.
Is this a drag or what?
Minnie Jean said as she joined us on the walkway to the front door. I liked her feisty way of putting things. She always said just exactly what she was thinking, as though she weren't afraid of anything or anybody.
Are you under lock and key the way I am?
Every minute of every day, I feel like a prisoner in my own house, I said. Mother walked ahead of us, ignoring our gripes. Mrs. Bates' home, a long, rambling ranch-style house, was set on the side of a hill. It appeared to be one story high, but there were rooms snaking down the back of the hill to a second level. What made it so beautiful was its spaciousness and its modern decor, the likes of which I had only seen in magazines or movies before. But despite its grandeur, the huge bay window in the living room made me fret about her safety at night. The living room was crowded with all kinds of people, most of them strangers. They were laughing and chatting as though there were a big celebration going on. It was the first time I'd seen people of that many different colors and types in the same room. As I approached the downstairs rumpus room, I could hear Ernest Green and Terrence Roberts mimicking the prejudiced newscasters who'd use the word nigra for Negro.
Well, I understand you folks are going to a new school, Ernest quipped. I hear the welcoming committee was dressed a little odd. Did you say they were wearing helmets? All of them wearing uniforms and carrying rifles? I wonder why. Did they offer you a cool lemonade and say they'd carry your books?
What a relief I felt to laugh aloud, a real deep rumbling belly laugh. I felt my insides loosen up as the two boys continued doing a parody of our dilemma. Jefferson joined the other boys in their skit, making more fun of our predicament. We girls could not match the boys' humor. They were like three seasoned comics performing at their peak on a nightclub stage. As we made fun of ourselves and our situation, Elizabeth Eckford, silent and obviously still shaken by her ordeal, arrived with Thelma Mothershed. Down the steps came Gloria Ray, followed by the always good-natured Carlotta. Our giggles got louder and more prolonged. We were happy to see each other, and in no time we were all talking at once. Just for that moment, we were snatching a tiny slice of normalcy for ourselves, although it was apparent all of us had questions about what would come next. For the first time in many days, I felt my whole self relax. I took a seat and sipped my Grapette Cola. Someone turned the music up, and it sounded to me like we had a party going. The sounds coming from the adults upstairs were just as festive. I was feeling okay, safe, and very normal, until I noticed that a man with a shotgun resting on his shoulder was strolling back and forth outside the rumpus room window. The fear knot in my stomach tightened. For me, the party was over. Not long after that, Mrs. Bates called us to come upstairs. "We'll get started now, if you kids will quiet down and take a seat," said the slender, stylishly dressed NAACP president. Two very dignified and important-looking men sat at the center of the room. I recognized one of them as Arkansas NAACP attorney Wiley Branton, a man of average height with milky skin, hazel eyes, and auburn hair. He could easily have been mistaken for one of the white men who opposed us. He explained that we were smack dab in the middle of what was fast becoming a major historical fight involving the governor of Arkansas, the U.S. courts, and President Eisenhower. "What we're in now is a waiting game," he said. "Waiting while everybody squares off and chooses upsides. We're all rooting for Judge Davies and the federal law to prevail." He went on to say that Central High was off limits to us, but not for long. He advised us to keep close to home and let someone know where we were at all times. Two women from our community had been pulled out of their cars the night before and beaten. Several of our people had been attacked in broad daylight. He warned us that this was not the time for socializing, and especially not for being out at night. We also learned that one of us might be required to testify in a federal court hearing about what happened on the day we tried to enter Central High. "All that means is telling the truth," he said. "Truth?" I whispered. But I had sworn to Grandma and Mama not to tell the whole truth. I'd have to put my hand on the Bible. I hoped and prayed I wouldn't be the one chosen to testify. I also wondered if I should tell him about Mama and me being chased that day at Central and about the gunshots into our windows. Maybe if he knew about that, he wouldn't call on me to testify. But I could hear Grandma India's voice in my head saying if we made a big thing of it and our names got in the papers, those segregationists might feel compelled to come back and finish the job, just to prove a point. I kept my mouth shut. "It appears that the segregationists are prepared to resist our school registration harder than we'd anticipated," Branton said. "But we're doing everything we can to get you into the school. We need your cooperation. It's going to take time and energy." He asked us not to register at another school and to make sure we kept up with our classwork until the issue was resolved in the court. "For how long?" I asked. All nine of us were good students. I was worrying about measuring up to those white kids in Central who'd had better books and equipment all through school. Central was supposed to be one of the top high schools in the nation. "How long can we afford to stay out of school?" A chorus of voices chimed. "For as long as it takes," Branton replied. 8. Dear Diary, the 2 days since I first went to Central felt like I was living in some stranger's life. Today, I won't think of integration. I won't think of Central High, and I won't think of the white people. I will spend the whole day finding the perfect disguise to wear to the wrestling matches. No matter what, I'm going to be a regular person. I'm going to have my usual date with Grandma and my secret pretend date with Vince at the matches. As hard as I tried not to care, I couldn't start my morning without knowing what the governor, his National Guard, and the school board were up to. I had to face the awful truth. Grandma was right. I was letting those people determine how I felt and how I lived a great part of my day. I brushed my hair back into a ponytail and headed for the front porch. As I picked up the newspaper, headlines leaped out at me. Halt in integration asked. Board seeks suspension of U.S. order. The Little Rock School Board was asking Judge Davies to suspend temporarily the plan for integrating Central High. He would be holding a hearing on their petition on Friday, September 6, today. I took a deep breath, preparing myself to digest the words I didn't want to see. School Superintendent Blossom was wimping out. After several years of selling his integration plan to the public, he was now asking the courts to suspend integration. He didn't say for how long, but even if it was only for a month, his asking would make segregationists think they were winning. They would surely know the next step would be to stop it altogether. I felt betrayed. The article reported that the board filed the delay petition after a meeting on Thursday morning, where a crowd of 400 circulated a petition demanding the resignation of Blossom and other school board members. As I read on, I wondered whether my eight friends had seen the same article and gotten as discouraged as I was. Would they abandon ship and go back to our old high school where life was at least tolerable? I was sinking deeper into a dreary mood when I saw the good news. Ike says he will use law, tells Faubus, cooperate with us. The federal constitution will be upheld by every legal means at my command, President Eisenhower had told Governor Faubus. The president had sent a telegram to Governor Faubus saying he was sure the governor, the National Guard, and other state officials would give full cooperation to the United States Supreme Court. The president also reassured the governor that rumors of federal authorities waiting to arrest him were untrue. I think the school board's backing off having the integration, I told my mother as she prepared to leave for school. Besides, the fight between the president and the governor is getting worse. Your faith is sagging. We live in a country where the law and the Constitution prevail. She smiled at me as she tossed her papers into her briefcase. Now, if only somebody would tell Mr. Faubus that. Be patient, Mother said, heading toward the car. By the way, I'm counting on you to give your grandmother extra special help today. She's a bit weary. Oh, no. I especially didn't want Grandmother India to be weary. I was counting on her to take me to the wrestling matches. For the rest of the day, I devoted myself to doing more than my share of the chores. I would do anything to keep her able-bodied and fit. As Friday evening descended upon me, I noticed the phone wasn't ringing. I had no invitations from school friends, no talk of what the boys were doing, no talk of meeting at the community center. I began feeling sad and lonely. Mother must have noticed because she said, "Why don't you call some of your other friends and make a date for a little fun? I'll drive you." "Can I make fun plans too?" Conrad asked. "I'm tired of this integration thing. Integration is no fun." "I know it seems that way, son, but you'll see. Soon things will be back to normal," Grandma told him. As I dialed my friend Marcia on the phone, I tried to remember how it felt to be normal. By this time of the year, had I been in my own school, my friends would have begun to form cliques. I counted myself in the middle-of-the-road good-girl group. We made good grades and behaved like ladies. We didn't meet with boys alone. We invested endless hours in planning for the time when we would date or listening to details from those who already were. Every now and then, we sneaked an accidental group date. That meant we happened to go to the same place at the same time as a group of boys we knew. The music and laughter in the background almost drowned out the sound of Marcia's voice as she answered the phone. Her voice was a little strange as she explained that several of our old friends were having dinner and they were going to have a pajama party. I waited for her to invite me, to say she'd forgotten and I should come right over. Instead, she explained that they didn't want me there because they feared segregationists would attack or bomb their homes to get at me. I stood for a long moment, holding the receiver to my ear, listening to the dial tone, blinking back tears. Mother came over to comfort me, but I felt as though it were the end of the world, at least the end of my own social world. I was no longer somebody people wanted to be with. I couldn't help saying aloud how I felt. Here I was, willing to face mean men with hanging ropes, give up my junior year among friends, and all the parties and fun to integrate, to make things better for everybody. But Marcia and the gang didn't see it that way. What I was doing wasn't important at all to them. Instead, I was someone to avoid. Some people are short-sighted, sweetheart. They can't see the future. They can only live for today. In the long run, you have to do this thing because you are convinced it is right for you, not for what others will think. But I don't want to lose all my friends. Well, let's not dwell on it. Marcia's not your only friend. Call a few others. I can't. They're mostly all at Marcia's house. Then we'll have a family date right here at home. We'll pop corn and watch TV and play games. Swell, I thought, as I dialed Minnie Jean, who was feeling the same as me, like she didn't know where she really belonged anymore either. As that boring evening wore on, the one thought that put a smile in my heart was the wrestling matches. Grandma and me, we'd be sitting right in the middle of all that fun in less than 24 hours. Government may try for an injunction against Farbus. Arkansas Gazette, Saturday, September 7, 1957. Governor Farbus had written a long telegram to President Eisenhower asking for understanding and support. He was also complaining that he had not had his day in court to show that he had been forced to call out the National Guard to prevent integration because the threat of violence was so great. I spent Saturday morning worrying that Eisenhower would take Farbus's side and school integration would be swept beneath some carpet for my grandchildren to retrieve. Between my dishwashing, reading the homework assignments Mother gave me, and answering hate phone calls, I managed to restyle my hair and try on everything in my closet, searching for a proper disguise. I was consumed with only one thought, Grandma, the wrestling matches, and my sneak date with Vince. I worried about leaving Mother Lois and Conrad home alone at night. Maybe the shooter would come again, but that worry was erased when Mother's sister, Auntie May, and her husband, Uncle Morris, said they'd come for dinner and stay late. As the morning turned into afternoon, I was busy keeping to myself so I could apply my grown-up makeup. It was an art I had not yet acquired since I wasn't allowed to wear makeup. Even by the third try, I resembled a circus clown. But as I looked in the mirror for a final check, I was proud of the job I had done. I was a new person. Promptly at 5, Grandma breezed into the front hall. She was dressed in church-going clothes, her Ladies' Day outfit, a blue suit with a matching hat that swooped down from its mischievous perch on the side of her head. "Well, don't just stand there, child. Help me find my parasol." I couldn't help smiling. The frantic search for the umbrella was a familiar scene. It made me feel that at least some part of my life was left intact. "We'd better go without it," I said. We were running late, and if we didn't hurry, the bus would leave us behind. I had been patiently waiting, hoping that at any moment my grandmother would signal her approval of my grown-up outfit, upswept hairdo, and high-heeled black patent shoes. Layers of forbidden makeup and dark glasses completed what I thought was the perfect disguise. The white people would never, ever recognize me from any picture they might have seen. Of course, my one big worry was that Grandma might say it was too grown up, but she only peered at me with a strange and lingering expression. "Let's go, Grandma, we're gonna be late," I said, trying to coax her toward the door. I was praying Vince wouldn't grow impatient waiting for me and leave, or worse yet, allow himself to be talked into spending the evening with one of the other girls. "Why don't you take a seat? I'll be back in a moment," Grandma said, sounding quite strange, beckoning me to remain there in the hallway by the door. I heard her and Mama whispering in the other room. As I settled into a chair, I thought about all the earlier times when we had gone together to the wrestling matches. Those matches were big events in my life because we traveled downtown to the Robinson Auditorium, a place usually reserved for white people only. Those were the times when I got to go outside my neighborhood, outside the world where I spent most of my life. We sat in the same room with white folks, able to observe them close up. I wanted to get to know them better, to see what it was they had that put them in charge. Besides, the wrestling matches had always been just plain fun. Sure, we suspected it was 30% wrestling and 70% make-believe. We couldn't have enjoyed it if we thought the wrestlers were really in pain, bleeding real blood and breaking real arms. Grandma India would adjust her hat, and then we would both strut down the aisle to the seats that Mr. Claxton had saved for us. He would always be there, waiting for us with the best balcony seats our people were allowed to have. After we got settled, I would complain about my thirst, and Grandma would grant permission for a trip to the soft drink stand. There I would meet Vince, as we'd planned, and take him to join Grandma and Mr. Claxton, explaining that our meeting had been accidental. I had enjoyed 8 evenings of double dating with Grandma and Vince, and she didn't even realize it. I knew full well my family would never have allowed me to date. They had said all along that when I was 18 and going to college, I could go out with boys, and then only in the company of a chaperone. As the evening wore on and the matches got really heated, Grandma India and I would behave as we behaved nowhere else. She would pound the floor with her parasol and shout and wave her fist until her hat was twisted on her head and her church-going outfit was rumpled. Once, she had even dropped her glasses and broken them in a fit of rage when her tag team favorites, Mud Mountain and Blue Moon Hog, were counted out by the referee. When it was all over, she would revert to her quietest and most cultured tone, speaking barely above a whisper. "Magnificent, child. That's the way a body gets rid of aggression without misbehaving. Now, Melba, straighten yourself up, honey. Time to present ourselves as the ladies we are." "Sorry, child. You can't go with me to the matches. Not tonight," said Grandma, grabbing me from my happy recollections. "Maybe next time, when the integration settles down." "But why?" I felt tears coming, but I had promised Grandma I wouldn't cry. "It's just too dangerous for you to go there amongst all those white people. They'll never recognize me. See? See?" I twirled about to show her that I was really a new person. Grandma India moved closer to me and cupped my face in her hands.
You're staying home, baby. It's for your own good.
Everything's been taken from me, I cried.
Your grandmother's right, honey. Mother Lois put her arm around my waist, trying to convince me it was not the end of the world. Suppose one of those people who saw us at Central recognizes you and tries to pick a fight. What about the risk to your grandmother?
I'll never go back to Central.
I ran from the room and locked my bedroom door, burying my face in the pillow so no one could hear me cry. Later, I wrote in my diary, "Freedom is not integration. Freedom is being able to go with Grandma to the wrestling matches." The next day, in the Sunday paper, I saw a pitiful close-up photograph of Elizabeth walking alone in front of Central on that first day of integration. It pained my insides to see, once again, the twisted, scowling white faces with open mouths jeering, clustered about my friend's head like bouquets of grotesque flowers. It was an ad paid for by a white man from a small town in Arkansas. "If you live in Arkansas," the ad read, "study this picture and no shame. When hate is unleashed and bigotry finds a voice, God help us all." I felt a kind of joy and hope in the thought that one white man was willing to use his own money to call attention to the injustice we were facing. Maybe the picture would help others realize that what they were doing was hurting everybody. Seeing that ad was the beginning of a wonderful Sunday. Just before church started, Vince walked right up and said to me flat out, "I want you to be my girlfriend." "Girlfriend?" I repeated the word, desperately groping to find just the right response. I'd never been asked before. As the organ music began, we found our usual seats in the pews to the right of center. From the pulpit, the minister looked down on us, 200 or so parishioners seated in that magnificently spacious room with a ceiling that rose 2 stories above us. The choir began with "The Old Rugged Cross," followed by "Were You There?" familiar hymns that were supposed to settle us into a state of grateful worship. As the sermon began, I felt guilty that I didn't have my mind on prayer. Instead, I was wondering whether Vince would give me a friendship ring or the letter from his sweater. It pushed all thoughts of Central High, Governor Faubus, and integration into the back of my mind. The minister was urging us to pray for Governor Faubus and do whatever was necessary to heal any sour feelings we had against white people. He had been organizing other ministers in Little Rock to speak out and condemn the governor for dispatching the troops. He said we should pray for the judges and city officials and the president to make the right decisions, to let us into Central High. Suddenly, my attention was drawn to what the prayer ladies were saying. They were calling my name, asking God to protect me when I walked into the lion's den at Central. I remembered what Grandma had said. "Church is the life's blood of our folks' community." I knew very well that without the church and the help of the people sitting around me, I had little chance of making it through that school year. Certainly, I couldn't count on the police. If I got into trouble and really needed protection, it would probably be the network of phone calls initiated by Reverend Young that would set off a rescue and construct a web of safety. Church was also the place where we exchanged the real news of what was going on within our community. It was the way we fit together the bits and pieces of information we got from our limited relations with whites. First one and then another would recount what they overheard in white ladies' kitchens, on their other jobs, or maybe on a bus. Already, we knew that the stories of our people buying up guns and knives were untrue. We didn't have that kind of money. Instead, one man said, some of our folks were digging in attics and closets, dusting off rusty hardware. "Reasonable folks smell trouble,"
There's too many strangers in town, too many people with Mississippi attitudes, he continued. Ain't no way we're out there buying hardware like the governor is saying. He's a stone-faced lie.
The big discussion on the lawn after church was all the questions white folks were asking our people about who was and was not planning to send their children to Central, and who was in favor of our going there. I heard rumors that two people were fired as maids at a local hotel because their answers weren't acceptable.
You're doing the right thing, girl. We're proud of you.
It might hurt a little while, but when it stops, we're all gonna feel real good.
You're making a mistake, but you're making it for all of us.
Those were some of the whispered goodbyes after church. Lingering among the crowd, as I always did, I discovered things weren't exactly normal, not even at church. Several people stood back and stared at me in silence. When I returned their gazes, some of them smiled, but others frowned.
Smile, no matter what, Mother said. Remember, not everyone approved of what Jesus did, but that didn't stop him.
U.S. Court Summons Served on Governor. Arkansas Gazette, Wednesday, September 11th, 1957. A week after our first attempt to get into Central, I was still rushing to get each morning's newspaper to read about the people who gathered daily in front of the school to see that we didn't get in. The president had agreed to give the governor a 10-day respite to sort out his response to the court order. There would be a meeting at Eisenhower's vacation spot in Rhode Island after that. The next day, we learned that Representative Brooks Hayes would go with Governor Faubus to a 5-man conference that included the President, Attorney General Herbert Brownell Jr., and Sherman Adams, Chief White House Assistant. I couldn't stop worrying that they were going to make a decision that could affect the rest of my life, and I wasn't getting to tell my side. What was worse was there was nobody invited who could say what was best for us.
Did you really think they'd invite any of our people?
Grandma India said as she stood tending her backyard garden. At least they could have had somebody like NAACP President Roy Wilkins or Mr. Marshall or some person of color. She laid down the shears, pulled off her work gloves, and peered above her glasses as she said,
Dream on, child, but don't lose faith. You've got the most important representative of all attending that meeting, your Heavenly Father.
I read and listened to every word of news about that meeting. I saw that Grandma did, too. We all felt the suspense, waiting to see whether or not Governor Faubus would convince the president to allow him to stop integration. Newspaper pages were filled with stories of their talk. Faubus wanted Eisenhower to delay integration for at least a year. Back and forth they went, with hopes for an agreement running high one day, rock bottom the next. Meanwhile, we 9 students were forced by circumstance to look to each other for social activities. Our lives were being totally dictated by preparations for what lay ahead at Central High. We were no longer a part of all those activities we had formerly excelled in, like after-school sports, student council, or choir and band rehearsals. Few of my old school friends telephoned, and when they did, they asked lots of questions about the integration. Questions I couldn't answer. On September 15th, the Arkansas Gazette headlines read, Faubus asking compromise, Ike refuses commitment, status of troops still unanswered. Realizing that the dilemma of integration wasn't going to be resolved quickly, everybody seemed to be concerned about our falling behind in our schoolwork. Teachers from our community, along with other professionals, were offering to give us books and to tutor us. Dr. Lorch and his wife, Grace, the couple who had helped Elizabeth escape the mob, organized tutoring sessions and structured them along the lines of regular classes. It felt good to dress in school clothes and go to Philander Smith, our community's college. For part of each day, I studied schoolwork and spent time with my 8 friends, enjoying a thimbleful of normality. Being together in those classes, the 9 of us were developing a true friendship, becoming closer knit than we might have been under other circumstances. We talked about our fears, what we missed at our school, and our hopes that the integration issues would soon be resolved. While I regretted the friendships I was losing, I cherished the growing ties to the 8. Just before the court hearing where Governor Faubus would be called to account, the 9 of us were summoned to Mrs. Bates' house to meet with the press. Nothing had changed since our last meeting. The troops were still in place around the school, and every morning the crowd of segregationists grew larger. Governor Faubus was still predicting violence. Several very dignified and important-looking men sat in her living room. One was the NAACP attorney, Wiley Branton. I recognized another man whose picture I'd seen in the newspapers, the famous lawyer Thurgood Marshall, the man who had delivered the argument that resulted in the Supreme Court's 1954 school integration ruling. Judging by my father's height, I figured Mr. Marshall was more than 6 feet tall, with a commanding presence, fair skin, and brown hair and mustache. He spoke like somebody on television, his sharp, quick New York accent overlaying a slight southern drawl. "At the same time, we are petitioning for a court order to force your governor to move his troops away from Central's front door. We'll be planning other options. Meanwhile, we are asking that you be patient. Justice will prevail." He spoke confidently, in a way that made me feel that I deserved to be admitted to Central High. I looked at this man, who seemed to have none of the fears and hesitation of my parents or the other adults around us. Instead, he had a self-assured air about him, as though he had seen the promised land and knew for certain we could get there. We had only heard rumors of freedom, but he had lived it, and it showed in his every word, his every movement, in the way he sat tall in his seat. He urged us to prepare ourselves to testify in federal court if need be. Right then and there, I began to fret about the truth I couldn't tell. If I testified in court about what really happened to me, it would get printed in the newspapers, and those men would come after us again. But now I knew that, worst of all, it would give the governor yet another excuse to keep us out of school. The very basis of his argument against our integrating was that it would cause so much violence that blood would run in the streets. If I told the judge about the men chasing us and shooting through our windows, the governor could use my words as weapons against us. But as I listened to Mr. Marshall speak, I felt much better. His positive attitude gave me hope that even if I couldn't speak my truth, the scales of justice were weighted on our side. I had read that he had faced up to other Southern segregationists and forced them to let my people run for public office. He had also fought for equal rights for women. I felt honored that he would take the time and energy to fight for our rights. There was no doubt in my mind that if any soul on this earth could get us into Central High, this great man, Mr. Thurgood Marshall, was the one. During the meeting, the upstairs had filled with a throng of news people, most of them white, with just a sprinkling of our people. We students were directed to take our seats and to answer questions as clearly and briefly as possible. For the first time, we were introduced as the Little Rock 9. Cameras flashed, bright lights stung my eyes, and reporters asked lots of questions for the next half hour. Many of the reporters asked the attorneys what they planned to do to get rid of the troops, and questions were directed to Elizabeth. She seemed shy about answering, but with Mrs. Bates' help, She forced herself to say a few words. Eventually, however, questions were directed to all of us. My heart raced with fear and anticipation as I observed the process. I was almost hypnotized by the wonder of it all.
Miss Patillo, how do you feel about going back to Central High?
Miss, I whispered as my hands perspired and my knees shook. Thoughts buzzed inside my head like bees disturbed in their hive. It was the first time anybody white had ever called me Miss. They cared what I thought. I struggled to find a suitable answer. We have a right to go to that school, and I'm certain our governor, who was elected to govern all the people, will decide to do what is just. I felt myself speak aloud before I was ready. Who said that? It sounded like me, but the words, where had they come from? The white reporters wrote my words down and behaved as if what I said was very important. Pride welled up inside me, and for the first time, I knew that working for integration was the right thing for me to be doing.
Mrs. Patillo, how does a mother decide to send her daughter into such a dangerous situation?
Mother Lois was sitting, shy and quiet, in a shadowed corner of the room. I could tell she was startled by the question. Nevertheless, she stood and said, "Indeed, it is a hard decision, but we are a Christian family with absolute faith that God will protect her, no matter what." After the main session, reporters pulled each one of us students aside for what they called one-on-one interviews. Listening to all the talk about our being heroes and heroines made me proud of Mama and Grandma and all of us. I wished Grandma could tell the reporters how she stood guard and made the shooters go away. Then they would know she was a heroine, too. When the conference broke up, I lingered in a quiet corner, soaking up the sights and sounds around me. I was fascinated by the way the reporters wrote so fast in their narrow notebooks and spoke into their handheld tape recorders. Their confident way of moving about and their quick, sharp talk made them appear as though they knew they were free. At the very least, they were in charge of their own lives. The way they responded to me made me feel equal to the white reporters. They looked me directly in the eye. I never saw any sign they were thinking of calling me a nigger. Some of them looked at me with admiring eyes and answered all my questions about their work without making me feel silly for asking. They also behaved as though they were genuine friends with the people of color among their ranks, sharing work and laughter. I felt a new fountain of hope rise up inside me. Just maybe, I thought to myself, just maybe this is what I want to be when I grow up. If I were a news reporter, I could be in charge of a few things. That night I wrote in my diary, "Today is the first time in my life I felt equal to white people. I want more of that feeling. I'll do whatever I have to do to keep feeling equal all the time. I apologize, God, for thinking you had taken away all my normal life. Maybe you're just exchanging it for a new life." Hope of settlement fades as governor faces day in court. Arkansas Gazette, Thursday, September 19th, 1957. The town was crowded with journalists from around the world. Their frantic phone calls asking for interviews before the hearing only added to the anxiety we felt because hecklers continued ringing our phones off the hook. I was relieved when we were told to refer all requests to the NAACP office. The federal court hearing would be one of the most significant in history. A precedent-setting decision could be made that affected the whole country. That's what all the newspaper reporters and radio announcers said over and over again. States' rights advocates from surrounding southern towns were up in arms. They were headed for Little Rock to add to the incendiary feelings in our town. The segregationists were doing a lot of newspaper advertising to get people to participate in their rallies. The Arkansas National Guard remained at Central High.